top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
Strange case. No sign of violence, yet she looks completely contorted in fear. Almost as if she'd been frightened to death. As if she'd seen something too horrible to live through.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 209, Zombie Nightmare. Most zombie films fall into one of two categories. In its original conception, we're talking in the 30s, White Zombie had the horror of actually turning into a zombie and being undead. The most predominant version is, of course, the zombie that comes back to kill you. Very rare indeed is the vigilante zombie who's brought back from the dead solely for retribution.
Well, not necessarily, though, because I do believe White Zombie, with the Haitian zombie myth, that they were brought back from the dead, not so much for retribution, but to be slaves, to Bela Lugosi's character, Myrtle Legendre. Now, I could be mistaken, but they were brought back from the dead for a purpose. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned zombies, just because last night I rewatched for the umpteenth time the stunning Criterion reissue of Night of the Living Dead. I got it on Blu-ray. And I got to say a couple things. Number one, that movie holds up immaculately to this day.
I think I know where you're going with this one.
Oh, yeah?
And two.
No, it's just amazing. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Number two, there was something I noticed that I never really noticed before, and that is during some of the expository moments when they're talking on the radio and on the television set and so on, and they mentioned that the zombies that are being reanimated are those that are unburied. In other words, it's the unburied dead that are coming back to life. I had always assumed that it was, like, as you would see in all the Italian ones, the zombies crawling out of their earthen tomb and whatever, digging away. I always assumed that that's what was going on in Romero's world that he created in both Night, Day, and Dawn. So I was a little confused. I was like, whoa, is it unburied? And then I thought to myself, well, hey, you know, I mean, they don't look that decomposed, right? They look pretty young. So yeah, I guess it's just the recently dead that were resurrected in the Romeroverse. That being, of course, canonical three, Night, Dawn, and Day. So an interesting little wrinkle in the sense that the reanimation was the recently deceased. Something, it's amazing. I mean, this film has been out for so many years and I've seen it over and over and over again. And it wasn't until now that I've noticed this. Many, many people, I'm sure, still perceive the Romero zombies as coming out of their final resting place, but we never see it happen. Mm-hmm. We just see the zombies shambling about, but we never actually see them rise from the dead. Because when you look at the assortment of zombies in all three films, you don't get these AKs, these Alta Cuckers, you know? You're getting these pretty young, sprightly zombies. And so, I don't know. I mean, this is a tangent. It has nothing to do with Zombie Nightmare, but it just sort of added a new little wrinkle to this world that I've been loving and part of for so long. And again, I'm just going to say one more time, for a film of that vintage, I mean, it had me on the edge of my seat. It doesn't matter how many times I've seen it, it doesn't matter. And it's kind of funny too, because the restoration that Criterion did was so fantastic that some of the effects, like, you could really see, you know, the makeup, you could see where the latex was peeling off, what have you. But it's just a testament to Romero's direction and the taut pacing and the script and the characterization, and it had me on the edge of my seat. So that's, I don't know, I guess it's a bit of a tangent, but we were talking Zombie Nightmare, we're talking about a zombie movie. So where did you said you knew where I was going? Where did you think I was going?
Oh, well, I thought where you were going is that because of Ben, this iconic figure, this hero of zombie lore and legend, I thought this movie could have had a similar hero who was African-American, because I was reading in Canucksploitation that the original envisioning of this project was, well, a black protagonist, which would infuse this with a lot more, let's say, social interest than Thor, who was cast in the role. which I thought was really weird, is you imagine like a black guy getting run over by white suburban teens who gets resurrected by a voodoo priestess to exact revenge. It's a lot more compelling than some bodybuilder. So I thought that was really weird.
Like, bodybuilder for maybe like half the movie until he was so...
replaced.
obviously replaced by a stuntman. We'll get into that. But no, it's interesting that you bring up Ben played so wonderfully by Dwayne Jones because, again, in the original Night of the Living Dead, that role was not written for a black person or a white person. It was just written. And Dwayne Jones just happened to be the best. And when this film came out right in the heart of the civil rights movement, and you know, here you have Dwayne Jones acting as a de facto leader, and you know he's got Mr. Cooper downstairs who pretty much has all the hallmarks of like some intolerant bigot and what have you, and you would almost expect like, you know, these people be, you know, calling him boy and stuff and treating him like a piece of shit, when they just treat him like another human being. And as we watch the film now, we're like, well, that's not shocking at all. But in 1968, when
that in the midst of the civil rights era and all that stuff happening,
you didn't see black people portrayed so heroically, and you never saw the fact that their race was never made an issue. If you did see them portrayed heroically, there was at least some sort of scene where, you know, they'd have to go up against a bigot and some sort of mutual understanding.
Or even be saved by a white guy. Or have some sort of white...
the white savior, et cetera.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, and this is another, just, you know, of course, the wonderful, wonderful, yet horrific and tragic, denouement of Night of the Living Dead, where there is a white savior, but he kills the wrong person.
Yeah.
And because of the fact, and that would have been tragic whether or not Dwayne Jones' character was white or black, because he's a hero through and through. And he's killed by a needless bullet, needlessly. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he's black has made it all the more resonant and tragic. So it's interesting because a lot of people say that Night of the Living Dead is imbued with so much social commentary. And in a lot of ways it is. But it's not so much the commentary of the race relation. That was just incidental. A lot of it is commentary about militarization and... industrial military complex and the themes that Romero would return to for the crazies and so on, and of course with Day and Dawn and so on. But you know, it's Night of the Living Dead was a film that changed cinematic history forevermore, and it's up there with Citizen Kane as far as I'm concerned, or some of the French New Wave films, or the Battleship Potemkin, or whatever film you want to cite as one of the greatest movies ever made, or one of the most important movies ever made. Night of the Living Dead is up there with that. Now, of course, Night of the Living Dead begat two wonderful sequels, and then some sequels of varying quality, and then we have this whole cottage industry of zombies, and they run the gamut. They run the gamut from serious and scary to... I wouldn't say silly, but like more puerile in a sense, like, you know, you're full of zombies and stuff. We're just all about the gore and guts. There's no social commentary. There's nothing there. And then as we've evolved with the zombie, and we are sort of maybe reaching, well, peak, I think we've already reached zombie saturation. I think that point has been reached about eight years ago. Yeah. But yeah, now we get the zombie who can be used for anything, comedy, buffoonery. You see them in fucking Geico commercials, etc. It's great because the zombie is such a malleable creature. You can do so much with it. No pun intended, because when you raise a zombie from the dead, you know, using like Haitian folklore or witchcraft mumbo-jumbo like in this film, you can't do anything with them. But as a vehicle for filmmakers, zombies can be used for anything. And they don't require a lot in order to realize on screen. All you need is a little bit of makeup. You know, a little bit of liquid latex, a few dabs of gray or blue or what have you. You need an actor who can affect a shuffling gait, and Bob's your uncle. You got your zombie. So, yeah, this is Zombie Nightmare from 1987, and this is a fairly infamous film because, well, anytime a film is lampooned on Mystery Science Theater 3000, it will forevermore be deemed a bad movie. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes that's an unfair designation. Sometimes I feel like they were reached, you know? But this is a bad movie.
This is wholly deserved.
Yeah, wholly deserved, but also wholly entertaining. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Thor. So we have our lead actor for this movie, Thor. And for those, you know, this is a name we have to explain, because most of our listeners, when we say Thor, they're probably thinking about the Norse god or the, you know, the comic book character played by Chris Hemsworth in the Marvel Universe. No, this is Thor John Michael Thor, obscure Canadian bodybuilder turned frontman of his, I guess, eponymous metal group.
Yeah, like Bon Jovi or Van Halen.
And he was Thor is a very, very interesting character. Do you know much about Thor?
Well, I mean, he carved a considerable pop culture niche for himself. Mr. USA, Mr. Canada, bodybuilding title holder. He would infamously, I think, bend metal bars with his teeth.
Which on is,
stage? I think, yeah, par for the course for strong men. Yeah. I don't know if he pulled a train behind him, like a caboose or something. That, but he's probably not strong enough, but he was a bodybuilder extraordinaire. The man was ripped.
Yep. I remember watching him on, he came in to visit the Much Music Studios for an interview and a performance, and this was actually the first time I ever saw Thor, and he does look like Thor. Like, he does have that resemblance, yeah. You know, at least back in the day he did. Not so much anymore, and I'll get to that afterwards. And there he was, his whole shtick. Plays some pretty good metal, but at the same time, bending the steel bars with his teeth. Another thing he would do is he would take hot water bottles, blow them up, till they exploded.
Amazing.
So this man was a real deal. Yeah. He was a strong man. And yeah, of course, when he would perform, he would be wearing like a loincloth or something.
Yeah,
like
and, sword and sandals metal. Yeah, like and power
he would,
metal.
Yeah, he would have some sort of you know, fancy motif on stage, and he would be slathered in oil. And John Michael Thor, he had aspirations, lots of aspirations, and one of them was to conquer the world of metal, and the other one was to conquer the world of movies. He is most notable for appearing in two movies, both with the word nightmare in the title, Rock and Roll Nightmare and Zombie Nightmare, and those are both cheese fest extraordinaire, but they're so much fun. I can't recommend Rock and Roll Nightmare higher. If you want to just kick back with a really fun, bad movie, go for Rock and Roll Nightmare, but Zombie Nightmare is pretty damn good too. Now, there was a documentary that came out recently called I Am Thor.
Which I've not seen. It came out 2 years ago. I'm chomping at the bit.
You really should see it because Thor did not have a happy life. I mean, he's still doing it. He's still doing the grind. He's still touring. He's a shell of his physical self. But after his very brief heyday in the late 80s, which really only extended to Canada, he suffered a lot. He suffered strokes. Uh-huh. He suffered crippling depression.
Was it related to his bodybuilding, the strokes?
I can't remember.
Huh.
Divorce, etc. So now, when you see Thor, he's still trying to play that superhero on stage, but he's balding, he's paunchy. He can still do the feats of strength, but it's interesting. It's a very interesting, unique look at a very enigmatic fringe character in the world of, let's say, music and cinema. John Michael Thor. Yeah,
I was rocking out to Lightning Strikes Again this morning. In fact,
By live, Lightning Strikes. Oh, that's
Lightning Crashes. Yeah, Lightning Strikes Again. I couldn't like help but notice the similarities between another band that has a song called Lightning Strikes, which is Dokken, of whom I was a big fan, and also Spinal Tap. It's unbelievable, and I urge listeners to check out the musical stylings of Thor, as it really is a distinct, very fleeting part of the metal scene, the power metal over the top thing, and the loincloth thing was not a happy time for music at that time, but it's quite hilarious.
I do have a Thor record on vinyl, probably his most critically acclaimed. I believe it's called something about the dogs, who let the dogs out or something. It's not who let the dogs out. I could bring it out right now and show you the cover. It's absolutely hilarious. A scantily clad Thor holding onto like leashes with like six dogs. But yeah, it's great stuff. But what's interesting is I Am Thor is that you see Thor the human, not Thor the joke. Because even when back in his heyday, he was a bit of a laughing stock.
Mm-hmm.
As you said before, the loincloth subgenre of metal was not one that was ever taken too seriously.
No. And here, like, he barely has a chance to acquit himself in the starring role because, as you said, like Plan 9 style, he's replaced by someone someone who's smaller and not of the same stature, who's covered up in a sweatsuit, so that to clearly, much like Bela Lugosi, was the replacement was covered up in some sort of cape. And they keep referring to him as this giant guy, but like the cops are looking for this giant protagonist, and we'll get into the plot here. Mm-hmm. And he's not giant, neither Thor nor his replacement, but they keep referring to him as such, and it almost is like, is that like projection that Thor wanted to be seen as giant? He's not a cutting figure, like a huge, he's, he was still like a maybe bodybuilder. Six feet tall, okay, if that.
Well, he was bigger than, you know, the other actors in the movie. He ended up being replaced midway through, and I don't know why. I did research upon research upon research as to why they replaced, because Thor does play the zombie for one scene. Mm-hmm. He is a zombie for one attack. Now, I don't know if Thor quit the production, if they fired him. I don't know what the backstage shenanigans were, but all of a sudden, because, you know, one thing that Thor is known for is his long mane. Mm. And usually platinum blonde, but in this movie it's more of a sort of brunette-ish, kind of sandy brown. But all of a sudden you see the zombie, and it's like, since when does a zombie go to supercuts? He's got short hair. He's got, it's black, jet black. Yeah, with black.
A weird white, like, skunk bald spot
yeah,
on the
top. Yeah, with this really conspicuous bald spot. And he was actually replaced, because I did, at the very bottom of IMDb, it says there's an actor by the name of Pee-wee Piemont. I don't even know if I pronounced that correct. And he's a stuntman, and he is uncredited for playing Zombie Tony. So that's just one of the many elements of this movie that make it fromage. But then there's other stuff. Like, I mean, what about Adam West? We'll get to that after. But we should or probably orient our listeners with a bit of a plot.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, this is a pretty simple stuff. Much like other horrors, you get a wonderful prologue where you get to see this pivotal moment in young Tony's life. And Tony is played by John Michael Thor. He's a young kid who witnesses his father coming to the aid of this young woman who's about to be sexually assaulted. The father is knifed by these two hoodlums who are committing the assault, and Tony grows up to be a good Samaritan himself.
So hold on, let's start right there. Let's go back right now. That scene was so fucking confusing because it was meant to be a period scene, right? It was meant to take place
from, I think, the 50s.
From the 50s, and yet everything about it was contemporary. Contemporary cars, contemporary attire, contemporary everything. So I was unable to
make that connection. It wasn't overt by any means.
When the film segues into modern day, you just think that this is continuing. You have no clue that there was a flashback. And when you see the heroic father come to the rescue of this young black lady who's about to be sexually assaulted by a couple hooligans, and then you see this person getting stabbed, and then in the next part you see... to me, I didn't even realize that was Thor's father. There are other connections.
Yeah, yeah.
Did they actually overtly say that, or are you just inferring that?
I am inferring it only because of the baseball uniform. When you first introduce to Thor, he's doing batting practice, and he's wearing a baseball uniform. And as a kid, the father took him to baseball practice. But by no means do they look alike, and there's no direct... I didn't make that causal connection off the bat either, but looking in the rearview mirror, I did after. But this is the testament to this poor filmmaker.
Because there is connection to other characters in the film, but... If that was assessment supposed to take place in the 50s, this is the 80s, that's 30 years on.
Yeah.
Thor is not playing, someone in his mid-30s.
There were no, like...
He's playing a character who's in his teens. So yeah. I don't think Thor witnessed the death. There was a death. The father was killed, but...
Well, then who would it have been?
That's the whole thing.
Well, certainly were no 1950s jalopies. There was no, like, period hairstyles. Like, that's why.
All they could have done was just a little subtitle saying... blah, 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 1957. It would have been totally disorienting yet again because everybody was dressed like they would in 1987, right? But still.
Yeah, or a little, like, duck, what do you call that hairstyle? Like, with a little bit of gel to pump up the hair. Like, there was nothing to indicate. It was confusing.
Or they could have had Tutti Frutti on the soundtrack. Yeah. Or just something to orient you. But there is no... So, right off the bat, you're disoriented.
Yeah.
Never mind that before even that prologue, we get a scene that, of course, is going to foreshadow events to come of a... Voodoo priestess uttering some mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, lighting candles in a cemetery, all that kind of stuff.
And then this monster comes out of a coffin, a really chintzy looking coffin, more like a large crate that you would see like on a boat bound for like, I don't know, Somalia or something. relief supplies, you know, that's really bad. But anyway. so just disorienting right off the bat. But yeah, you do have this good Samaritan character. He could very well, that could have been his father because he is being raised by a single mother. His name is Tony. He's a good kid. He's a strong kid. And he's also a star baseball player.
Yeah, and he frequents this corner bodega, this corner store, whose proprietor has, like, the worst, I mean, worst Italian accent imaginable. And this is filmed in Montreal, which is so many Italians.
Hey, Thor,
this Chef Boyardee accent.
I didn't forget the provolone. I know how much your mother loves a provolone. And which was so funny about this, too, is that he was supposed to go and get, like, groceries, you know, for, I guess, provisions to last, what, a week, maybe? And
the bag. It's a tiny little bag.
The proprietor has a paper bag that looks like it holds maybe like a ball of aspirin and a chocolate bar.
Yeah, well, he was going to
get some. But it's got the provolone. You know?
And so some wheat germ or something?
Well,
or
that was for Thor. Yeah,
Thor. So he could, like, some sort of, I don't know what that was for. Just some sort of, to add to his protein shake.
Yeah, it was
for
bodybuilding.
And so a couple of street toughs come in, bust into this guy's shop, armed, and Thor beats the snot out of them, throws them out of the store. Good Samaritan. He comes to the aid of this guy. He goes out into the street. And
his groceries are now free?
Yeah.
Oh, Thor. You remind me of Luigi from The Simpsons, basically. Exactly. You know? Thor, groceries are free for you. You go. You're a good boy. Well, unfortunately, Thor will never get to eat those. And we keep calling him Thor. Tony. Tony will never get to eat that provolone because all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, a car comes hurtling through the night, vehicular manslaughter, Thor, dead, gone.
Hit and run.
Hit and run. And these toughs that kill Thor, that kill Tony, are a bunch of hooligans who are, I guess you would say their leader is this awful mullet-headed nihilist. He just wants to...
nihilist.
Well, he just wants to kill him. Once he got a little taste of blood, that was all she wrote for him.
Yeah, and so instead of calling the hospital to take the deceased there, instead of calling the police, the small businessman takes the body of Tony to his mother's place and drops him on the lawn, as one does.
Oh, it was actually on a picnic table. It was on a picnic table, but yeah.
As one does, instead of first responders. And as one does, instead of, again, getting the coroner involved or making the arrangements for the funeral, notifying police immediately, she requests the presence of a voodoo priestess.
She's distraught, and she's not ready to say goodbye to her son, who really is her only source of caregiving and what have you. So she enlists the help of Molly McCombie, and this is the voodoo priestess that, once you connect the dots, was, you know, saved from an assault in the very first scene of the movie.
Maybe you say that, but I had the similar reaction to Tony, the young baseball player, because they... Yeah, I guess it's just by inference. Like,
well, that not, because then, you know, I don't want to spoil
well,
too
later,
much,
I guess, yeah, much yeah, later, the you make
captain,
the tie
yeah,
together.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Because there was a lot of revenge for a lot of different things involved in this movie. So Molly McCombie comes by, and there's Thor lying on the picnic table, and she starts...
Incantation.
And her voice sounds like a bleeding sheep. It's so...
Terrible Haitian accent.
Oh, my Lord. And they manage to resurrect Tony. He is now a zombie, and he will not rest until he tastes his vengeance, which means taking out the head punk, who I believe his name is Jim.
Jim Batten, yeah.
And his cronies, one of which was played by a young Tia Carrera in her very first
role. A.K.A. Cassandra, the total babe from Wayne's World.
Wayne's World.
So that's really young. She's probably like 17, and well, these toughs are fantastic. The lead tough is a Canadian director in his own right, directed a...
good research. I did not know this.
Yeah, his name is Sean Levy. He directed a...
That name sounds familiar.
A Steve Martin movie. Oh, it's not like too good to be true, but it's something like that. I can't remember the title of the thing, but he directed like several big-time productions. And so that was kind of weird. So you have some star power, and the lead detective who's investigating the spate of murders, because the body count starts to rise as the toughs, one by one, are picked off by this zombie seeking retribution, is, of course, Batman's Adam West, Adam West. That's right. It's a reference from Family Guy. Adam West is, I mean, and talk about like a completely just lazy performance.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about like, the expression is chew the scenery.
Right.
Which is someone who's just so over the top and, you know, enunciating words improperly and all this kind of thing. But this guy is chewing like the stogie in addition to the scenery. Mm. Like there's not a scene where he's not chewing on a cigar. Like he's some like Raymond Chandler, hard-bitten detective from the 50s. It is an awful performance.
Well,
and he gets top billing.
Adam, yeah, and he, you don't even see him until 45 minutes into the movie when he makes his first appearance. Yeah. But listen, Adam West has never once been accused of being a naturalistic actor. He's from the Shatner School of Acting, right?
Oh, no, it's true. Yeah.
So it's just this one performance, whether he's Batman, whether he's a police detective, whether he's, I don't know, I saw the sci-fi film he was in. He's always the same, but in this one, he really is phoning it in. It's hilarious, in fact, and this is apocryphal, but yeah, you mentioned this film was shot in Montreal, purportedly taking place in the States, but it was shot in the suburbs of Montreal, and with a lot of these Canadian productions, they would fly in a token American star that they can get in the cheap to add some marquee value, and in this case, they got West, and I'm sure, you know, the 87, the Batman series would have been off the air for at least close to 20 years, and he was definitely not in the prime of his career, so they probably got him for quite cheap. Well, Mr. West was drunk as a skunk every day on set and could barely remember his lines. So there's a one scene in particular when he's actually talking to one of the cops. And for most of the movie, he's sitting behind his desk in this police station that looks more like a travel agency.
Yeah, exactly.
His flimsy chairs, a desk, whatever. And he's reading an old dot matrix computer, a piece of computer paper, you know? And, you know, ostensibly you would think that he'd be reading, like, whatever, the police
file. Yeah.
He was reading his lines. Yeah. Those are his lines. He was reading off right then and there as the cameras are rolling. Hilarious.
Well, yeah, and the police, this is mostly police procedural, and what I found is just absolutely hilarious is he's the type of guy who just wants, is more concerned, because he's the captain, he's more concerned with the homicide clearance rate. All he wants is for the case to be solved. It doesn't matter who they pin it on, he just wants it cleared. And he's got an underling, an upstart, who's like new to the department, this guy Frank, who's also just an appalling actor. And they
was
there
anybody in this movie that wasn't
no no actor? True, that's what makes this so incredibly unique, because even like some of the just, you know, discarded dung from the dung heap of the horror realm of the mid-80s. I'm thinking another movie that had a heavy metal guy in it is Pledge Night. That seemed like absolute genius in comparison. At least you had the odd person, and that featured Joey Belladonna from Anthrax, so another metal tie-in. But at the very least, any of those films had at least one or two decent performances. This across the board was terrible. But the cops determine, because the MO of this killer is the same in each case, he snaps vertebrae. And he is so strong that he just crushes people like by the neck, essentially. He just hoists them up and crushes them with his bare hands. And so the coroner is this another just terrible character, Dr. Whoever.
Love who's it, like, love. This is the guy that was channeling his inner Peter Falk. Why is he talking like Columbo the whole, you know, throughout the entire, every time he delivered his line? It was hilarious. The guy was like, okay, this is my one big break.
And he's responsible for a bunch of gallows humor and all this stuff, but just wild. And also, which was also odd, as the killings progress, like the guy's MO changes, as does the actor who's portraying this role changes. So at the end, instead of crushing vertebrae, he starts slamming heads into windows, and which causes instant death for some reason because he's so strong. But he abandons his MO from the beginning and starts killing his victims in a completely different way. And yet he's constantly referred to as like they're looking for this big hulking guy, and he really isn't.
Thor is a big guy.
Sort of, but he's not a big guy like Lou Ferrigno from like 6'5", from that series, who's like, holy shit, you saw this guy in the street.
When you look at his antagonist in this film, Jim, this Sean Levy character that you said became, and that name does strike a bell, he's a string bean, right?
Oh yeah,
so compared to, I mean, Thor is a legitimate bodybuilder, he was a Mr. Universe or Mr. Canada or what have you, he's a big guy, and the stuntman they got to replace him.
But they replaced him and they put him in sweats, so you can't even tell.
But he was wearing sweats beforehand, he had the
hoodie. Well, I know, but at least you saw the guns, like at least a little bit, like whether he was like, you know, swinging a bat in batting practice, or like coming to the aid of like, you know, Mr. Gianluigi Bambino or whatever, this phony baloney Italian, like you could see this guy was ripped, and you could see these rippling pecs and everything, and then that is entirely wasted when you're just going to have some killer who's in sweats. This production is fraught with problems.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, yes, I mean, there have been many instances, or not many, but I mean, they're so notable that we say, you know, we just remember them. Of course, Plan 9 being the most egregious example of when you change an actor midway through the filming and you try and attempt to disguise it in whatever hacking way possible. But if you're going to film, like, there had to have been something behind the scenes, either Thor getting fired or quit, because
Well, his, I don't, his birthday does not even on IMDb. Like, it's within 2 years. So there's a lot of, like, murky backstory, right, you know, for this man.
Because the first act of vengeance, the first killing, it is Thor underneath the latex. He does look like the Wicked Witch of the East, but it's him. And he's, you know, he's got the long hair. And you could tell, it's Thor.
It was a fantastic killing, we got to say. It takes place in, of all places. Now, this is unique. This, at least, give them credit for ingenuity and uniqueness. I've never seen in my history of watching horror films by the hundreds, if not thousands, a killing that takes place on a squash court. So good for him. So these guys were playing squash. He comes and he throws one of them into like a hot tub, if I'm not mistaken, and the other one he crushes with a bat, like from behind, and that is clearly Thor. Yeah. And the rest of them is just some dude in almost like a Hans in Franz, like fitness attire.
For the rest of the movie, you have Molly McCombie with, you know, bedecked in makeup, reminiscent of Papa Shango from like WWE.
Oh, I thought like one of those like evil senseis from a Shaw Brothers.
That too.
Oh my God, yeah.
And like, now, white face. When she's summoning forth her zombie to continue his vengeance, it's this replacement. And I don't understand why, at the very least, they could have just, I'm thinking Samurai Cop, you know, at least as ineffective as that, at least they, when they went for the reshoots and after Matt Hannon cut his hair short, at least they gave him a very unconvincing wig. Why couldn't they have given this this Pee-wee Piedmont guy a wig to at least somehow have him resemble? I mean, he's now a zombie, so there, you know, things do change, but zombies don't get haircuts.
No.
They don't get haircuts. And they don't have these really bizarre asymmetrical bald spots on like the left side of their scalp. It's just very, very strange. And then when you add in the lunacy of Adam West's performance and the cheapness of this entire production. I mean, the whole thing is just a complete debacle from start to finish. It really is. This was not my first viewing. I've seen it before. I got such a kick out of it the first time.
Oh, yeah.
So I was really looking forward to revisiting it. And it's just as ludicrous the second time. Maybe it doesn't reach the heights of sheer ludicrousness as Thor's other starring vehicle, Rock and Roll Nightmare. Mm. You really, really have to seek that one out.
No, for sure.
But this movie is definitely, you know, again, I hate the sobriquet "so bad it's good." I really hate it, you know, because the way I see it, even a bad movie can be good if it's entertaining, if it's fun, if there's passion and heart behind it. This movie had no passion and heart behind it at all, but it was entertaining and fun. So, derided, sure. But is it worth watching? Most definitely. What did you learn?
Oh, so much, so much.
Yeah, because I don't have anything I learned.
Seeing, again, the lead bad guy is Jim Batten, this guy who has a Cure Boys Don't Cry poster in his room, or that might be another guy. He's this long-haired goon who has a switchblade. He attacks this woman, and he meets his maker very quickly as the zombie Avenger intercedes on her behalf. So when the police are investigating and questioning the witness, this rape victim, well, she wasn't assaulted, but she was in the midst of, she was going to be assaulted. The cop says, "So why did you go into the alley with him?" Which is, that's a terrible thing to ask of someone who's been victimized by assault. B, there was no alley to be seen whatsoever. It was a hedgerow. So he said, "Why did you go into the alley?" And he's pointing to a bunch of trees. There's no alley whatsoever. Another thing I learned, the great lines in this film, the same goon, is before he tries to sexually assault this woman, tries to pick her up. He's like some 18-year-old punk who lives at home. She is post-college, and she says, "Listen, I'm not interested in you." She turns him down, his overtures, and says, "I'm old enough to be your older sister," which I was on the floor with that one. That's so ludicrous. Like, well, what? Like, he's 18. She was what? 26. Like, right out of school. That's not so, like,
she feasibly could be 19 and be his older sister. Yeah, yeah. So
when you're out of college, you're like 21, and then like, oh, that phrase only has any sort of heft if you say, "I'm old enough to be your father or mother." It has none if you pick any other. Okay, grandfather, but who would say that? That's bizarre. So that was hilarious. Some weird kind of racism. Adam West's character refers to this voodoo priestess as being from the black section of town, which is just like totally cringeworthy.
Yeah, I cringed really when I heard that. Yeah,
so much to learn. You know, just terrible. Hilariously enough, though, all around.
She may be from the black section of town, but there's not one other black character in this entire movie. So, does the black section of town only consist of her? Is that why? Because she lives there, ergo it's a black section of town?
Well, it's just, yeah, you know, speaking of race, it just would have been so much, again, so much more impactful had there been the Tony character been an African American and then being antagonized by these sort of suburban toughs. That would have been so much more interesting, because then he would be also sought by the police as someone who's committing the murders. It would have been so much
let's not kid ourselves. Certain movies are made to be impactful, to have social criticism, to make you think. Other movies are made to make a quick buck. This was made for a quick buck. This was not, there was no intention whatsoever for any sort of audience elucidation or engagement or edification here. So I don't know, where did you find out about this?
I found this out from Canucksploitation.
Oh, okay. And
they're pretty good site. This is a really reputable site. Apparently they had issues with...
Paul Krug
with,
is a... Right?
Yeah, yeah. Terrific. Like their bona fides cannot be questioned. Apparently, this was to be filmed in upstate New York, and they had some issue, I read, with Teamsters, and the production costs were getting out of hand.
Yep.
And then, sure enough, what do you do when your production is fraught with problems? You go to Hollywood North, or in this case, just east of Hollywood North, which is Toronto, which would be Montreal. So you go there to shoot your production. They had issues with the director, who was ex-porn producer, Jack Braveman. This guy was at loggerheads with the head writer. The head writer took over the director's chair midway through. So this movie is just, yeah, just completely off the rails from the get-go.
Yeah, and then it probably got farted onto like three screens in like the spring of 87, and then it got shoved straight to home video.
Yeah.
And then it became bad movie, called Movie Infamy from there on in.
Yeah, and also a movie with zombie in the title, it's pretty rare that you get one zombie. So this must have like been really, people probably would have wanted their money back, you know, when they saw this, because they probably anticipated your straight ahead zombies attacking the populace movie that we've come to know and love from the canonical Romero films of the Italian movies in the 80s. This was one dude, and it wasn't even, and it also takes, it sucks the horror out of the movie when you're rooting for the ostensible antagonist, because he's back from the dead to exact revenge, so it takes away any sort of dramatic heft that this film would have had. So, like, filled with problems all across the board.
But would you still not recommend it?
To a certain extent,
What the fuck entertainment value of it all?
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure.
I mean, okay, so I there's not much I learned from this movie so much as further recommendations I'm going to give, and of course, I recommend our listeners see this movie, but I also, as I said before, Rockwell Nightmare is an absolute hoot, as long as you have the stomach to take interminable driving sequences.
a la Manos? Worse than Manos?
Well, at least driving sequences that go on and on endlessly to fill the running time and drag, kicking and screaming to feature length. sets some pretty cool heavy metal music, and then the absolute insane climax, which is Thor bedecked in some sort of like, I don't know, bedazzled Speedo and nothing else, battling the personification of Satan as a patently rubber hand puppet. Just completely insane. And, of course, his hair is teased up in that, glorious Bret Michaels fashion from that time. Okay. Oh, but before, and the other recommendation I want to give is I Am Thor. I Am Thor. Wonderful documentary. Yes, what else have you learned?
In keeping with this guy playing little league ball, one of the weapons he uses while a zombie is, of course, a baseball bat. And when he dispatches with one of the toughs, he hoists the bat into the guy's midsection, impaling him. And then as he flings the bat away, you can tell it's just rubber. So you can see, if you pause it, the thing is like bent. So, a metal baseball bat just bends. Hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. Interesting thing, too, about Thor, and I learned this from I Am Thor, from the documentary. This is a character. And when I say character, I mean the character that he created, John Michael. I don't think Thor is his real last name.
I couldn't find it. Well, I was looking for his height. Like he's got a murky, nebulous background.
Yeah, well, he's obviously modeling himself after the character in the comic books and the Norse god and whatever. And, he sort of has those Viking looks and the blonde hair or whatever.
He's maintained a low-key lifestyle.
I don't get it.
Loki? Thor?
Oh, my God. That's so bad. But anyway. Terrible. Did you ever see the film Adventures in Babysitting?
No.
One of my favorite films of the 80s. One of those formative films for me. And there's a character, a young girl, and she's obsessed with the character Thor, right, from the comics. And she thinks that Thor is real. And at one point in the movie, their car breaks down and they end up in an auto shop, and then the guy who's working on their car He's got the long hair. He's got the muscles. And she thinks that he's the living embodiment of Thor. Now, John Michael was meant to play that character. He was meant to play Thor in Adventures in Babysitting. I forget why, but it fell through. It just seems that with John Michael, it was one piece of bad luck after another, after another, after another. And one thing that you get from the documentary, though, is his resiliency. He just keeps on soldiering on, soldiering on, soldiering on. Yes, he's trying to recreate some glory days that have never happened. And interestingly enough, the actor that ended up playing that Thor character in Adventures in Babysitting was Vincent D'Onofrio.
Whoa.
Yeah, a young Vincent D'Onofrio. So, but that was meant to be John Michael. That film was shot in Toronto. So, yeah. That's about all I got to say.
Well, you'd have to be pretty hammered to enjoy this one. I'm going to give it a star. I could go on. You're in the puns, man. Cue okay. The band, man. I'm going to give this one star as a piece of filmmaking, a cohesive piece of filmmaking, half a star as a piece of horror entertainment from a weird, misbegotten piece of metal horror trash. I'm gonna give this 2.5 for just for sheer entertainment. Your star rating?
Well, I just give it a star rating, period. And I'm gonna give this 3 stars.
Okay, fantastic.
Sheer, what the fuck, entertainment value. You can't go wrong. You know, and of course it depends what you want out of your evening's entertainment. But if you just want to turn off your brain and watch something just batshit insane and crazy, you can't go wrong with Zombie Nightmare.
I want to put on some Thor on vinyl here, like right after we record right now, this. Yeah. Let's do it. And for more, check out our podcast every week with new episodes, www.reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.